Hey, it's Brandon Dawson. Welcome back to another episode of Building Billions with Brandon Dawson. I have a very special guest today. I've known this guy now for, I don't know, probably
more than
15,
a decade.
Yeah, 15 years, 14 years. And I knew him when he had a little tiny business, just like every other entrepreneur with a big dream, starting out in a small town. And Henry, introduce yourself. Tell everybody what company you're with, and then we're going to kick this thing off.
Yeah, great. I'm excited to be here with you, Brandon. Feels like 14 years in the making. My name's Henry Shuck. I'm the founder and CEO of ZoomInfo. ZoomInfo is a publicly traded company that helps businesses identify their next best customer by giving them data on companies, the individuals at those companies who make decisions, and then how to connect with them, email, phone number, contact information. And then what we layer on top of that is data that tells you when a company is in market for your products and services. So when are they doing research on the types of products and services you sell? When are they going to make a purchasing decision on the types of products or services you sell? And then who are the people who are making those decisions?
Crazy. Now, literally 14 years ago, you and I were sitting in my office and in Vancouver, Washington, right? And we were having a conversation about what your dream was, what you were going to build, your vision for the organization, your appetite to do something huge, and the fact you were one of the first aggregators and visionary for big data.
Yeah.
And I remember sitting there listening to you thinking, I wonder who all would use these services. It reminds me of how small I've been thinking my whole career, right? So no matter how big at the time I thought I was thinking. And so back then when we met, I think you were, what, probably $3 to $5 million in revenue?
Something like that, yeah, $5 million.
Today, how big is your company today?
$1.2 billion.
In revenue?
In revenue, yeah.
How much in value?
You know, trades every day.
Yeah.
Today, around $7 billion.
Seven? Now, listen, listeners. 14 years ago, a dream doing $3 or $4 or $5 million in revenue to change access to information for people to use to build their businesses. Back then, in fact, when we first met, it was called Discover.org,
I think. Yeah, that's right. Yep.
And here we are today with a business, $7 billion company. Like, what's it feel like just saying $7 billion?
Well, here's what's interesting. When I met you, the reason why I met you was there was a woman who was like helping community business people with like funding from the state or training programs for employees. And I asked her, hey, listen, I don't know what I'm doing. This is the first business really I've ever run. And it's getting bigger every day. And I don't really know how to like run a meeting or manage my leadership team or think about building a business. Do you know anybody that I can go talk to or someone who might mentor or be a coach for me? And she was like, actually, I know exactly the guy you should go talk to. You should talk to Brandon Dawson. And I think when I think about that and what you're doing now and the platform that you have to do it is just doing that on this big, big scale. But, you know, at $5 million in revenue when we first met, you know, I didn't really know, again, what I was doing. My hope was every year I could double the size of the business and I could see out a year, basically, as far out as I could see. I could say, listen, I know what's working well now. If I can just replicate that a little bit more and scale it a little bit more, I can double it every year. And that's what we focused on doing. But, you know, look, as I sit here today, and you know how this is, I'm proud of the company that we've built. I'm not satisfied with the company that we've built. Mm-hmm. I know it has more potential than what we've put together today. And so, you know, when I say $7 billion, I'm actually like a little bit embarrassed by the number because I know that there's so much more that it could be. We can build a much bigger company. There's much more potential there. So there's this constant push to keep going even at this stage.
Well, man, I want everybody to hear this because it's so consistent with all the entrepreneurs I've talked to and for those that are succeeding. Those that are struggling are like, I just want it to be good. I just want it to be comfortable. I just want it to and you know, 97% of all businesses under 100 million fail every 10 years. So you think about both of us, we both, you know, I exited, I'm on my next one. You've taken yours from 5 million to 7 billion in value and you're not satisfied. So for everyone listening to this, look, the show is Building Billions. And I feature people who have built companies of all sizes. But I talk about how to build a billion-dollar company, which is what I've been doing the last 4 years. And I talk about the exit I have at 77 times EBITDA. But my God, I can't fathom you built a $7 billion valued company and you're still sitting here saying, I'm not satisfied. I know it could be bigger. I know it could be better. I want everyone to just think about that as you're listening to this. Because what I have found with champions, with people who are serious about building unbelievable businesses, is no matter how big we get, we're always dissatisfied because we know we can be bigger.
Yeah.
And then if you're listening to this and you're like, oh man, if I only got to 5 million or I only got to 10 million or I only got to 50 million, I'd be so satisfied. The truth is, it doesn't matter what number you hit, you're never going to be satisfied.
Yeah, that's right. When we started the business, I said, like, I remember I had this notepad where I wrote like optimal size of the business and it was like 8 people. you know, today we have 3,500 people and I do think I just went on a vacation with my family and I was with a friend of mine and he said, so how does it work now? Like, are you like built a big enough business that you can kind of work 2 or 3 hours a day and you can have like lots of days off? And I was like, no, it doesn't work like that. Like, I'm working hard every day. Look, today I'm here in Scottsdale. I got back from my vacation at 6:30 last night. I took a 6 a.m. flight to be in Scottsdale today to meet with customers and prospects at a conference. And I fly back tonight at 11:20 on a red eye to be back home at 6 a.m. so that I can sleep a few hours and get going again. And none of that, like, it doesn't really phase me. I'm doing like the necessary things to build a bigger business and so that we can reach the potential that I think we have at the company. And so I don't have 2 or 3 hour days. I have this constant push that we can be better and I haven't met my potential yet. And as long as that feels that way, I'm going to push as hard as I can.
And you love the impact of what you're doing.
I do.
And you've always been, I mean, I remember when we first met, you were sitting across from me. I still remember that day like it was yesterday.
Yeah, I do too.
I just wish I would have wrote you a check for half of your company. That's what I wish I would have been like, hey, what's it going to cost to buy half this company? You know, it's just insane. Two guys from a little town. I mean, I used to say I built one of the most successful entrepreneurial businesses in Vancouver, Washington. And then I say, next to Henry. I remember running into a couple of your guys when you first started at the gas station. And they're like, oh, yeah, Henry talks about you. And I'm like, oh, yeah, how's it going over there? And they're like, oh, good, we're growing. Never did I think that we'd be sitting here a few years later with a $7 billion company being pissed that it's not $50
billion. Yeah, totally.
Which I think speaks to the quality of person you are, because most entrepreneurs by now would have probably tapped out. The complexity of going from owning your own business, the whole private equity cycle,
yep,
and then IPOing your company, and then the whole public company cycle, and the just the friction, resistance, constraint that can come with that if you run into friction.
You know, the hard part, as I'm sitting here thinking about it, is I spend a lot of time thinking about, am I doing the right thing for this stage of the business? Am I spending my time in the right places? Am I recruiting the right people? There's no blueprint. And there are only like a handful of people who've done it beyond the stage that I'm at. And what you really want in an ideal world is some kind of blueprint that tells you, like, or some kind of validation, you're doing the right thing. This is the right, you're making the right decisions. So I spent a lot of my time today just making sure that I'm focused on the right thing, that I'm allocating resources properly, that I'm doing the things that'll get us to the next stage. And there's no very clear map of what that looks like.
I mean, you know, I've engineered 11 breakpoints to $1 billion, but to think about going from 1 billion to 10 billion is a whole nother technical move. talk a little bit about, like, what was the biggest moment for you in the growth cycle where you were like, I did it, versus I got, you know, I know that you're not satisfied with no matter how much success, because you're that kind of person. But what was the point where you took a deep breath at some point and went, I actually did it? Where was that in the business cycle?
IPO?
Yeah.
Like IPO day, we IPO'd in the middle of the pandemic. It was June 4th, 2020. We opened the market. Stock went up like, I don't remember, 40, 50%. It was this great day. Also, the market, I was in Vancouver, Washington when we did this, and the markets close at 1 o'clock Pacific. And so the market closed. My day was kind of like over, and it started at 2 a.m. And it was a beautiful day. It was sunny. And I had like the rest of the afternoon to like call some friends and hang out with my wife and drink champagne. And then have we had 20 people over that night. That was a great moment because it felt really validating. And I'll tell you, I think the biggest reason why that moment stands out is along the way, you bring people along this journey and you basically tell them, like, give me your life.
Yep.
And I will pay you back at some point. And they have to really believe that you will pay them back at some point. And then a handful of them really do give you their lives. They give you basically every waking moment of their lives for a decade or more. Yep. And so that day felt like, you know what? All of those promises I have delivered on for my people who gave me their lives. That felt really like, felt like a relief. And then the other piece that I felt really strongly at that moment was, maybe this is actually my calling. Like I came to the world to do this thing. Like that's what it felt like at that moment. So that was one. The second one so I started a company called Discover.org. Company grew. And we had an opportunity to acquire one of our closest competitors, a company named ZoomInfo. When you go out and do these acquisitions, in this case specifically, we raised debt to do the acquisition. And it was a big enough amount of debt that we actually had to go get debt rated. So like when you hear like a junk bond or a, you know, B minus bond, I didn't know what that was until I was literally in the room with Moody's pitching this acquisition. And we had to raise at the time, you know, $1.2 billion of debt to go do that acquisition. And then you build these models and plans for what, you know, good looks like if the acquisition works the right way. What are sales going to look like? What are the efficiencies you're going to get? How are you going to be able to drive demand? How do you bring the two cultures together? We make this acquisition kind of on a Monday. And on a Thursday, I knew it was going to be an incredibly successful integration and acquisition. And everything where I thought would be okay turned out great. Mm-hmm. Things that I thought were going to be good were great. The teams were coming together. The customers were like really latching on to the vision of the acquisition. And so I remember calling my private equity investors that Thursday. And they're like, so how's it going? I was like, it's better than we expected. And we expected something great, like a great outcome, but it's way better than that. I remember that moment feeling like, okay, this,
thank God.
Thank God. Yeah, yeah.
How big was your business when you raised $1.2 billion?
It was $170 million in revenue. And then ZoomInfo was another $105 million in revenue. And so combined the business, you know, almost $300 million when we combined it.
Wow. And you raised $1 billion. You paid $1.2 billion for that.
So I had to raise $1.2 billion because we had done another acquisition the year before at like 300-ish million.
So you're recapping that.
I was recapping that. And then about $800 million to buy ZoomInfo.
Man, and you think, those are scary moves because you're like, if this does not work out, I'm going to be in trouble.
The first acquisition I did, we acquired a company called Rain King, and it was like a $300 million-ish acquisition. And I remember the day before we announced it to the team. So we closed on a Friday. We all flew to Washington, D.C., took over their offices for the weekend to do all the planning and make sure all the pieces were in place. And I remember the Sunday before the Monday we announced, I was literally having a panic attack. And I called one of my investors who happened to be in Maryland. I was like, hey, will you come meet me for lunch? And we met for lunch and he's like, how's it going? I'm like, I think, I I think this is a panic attack. Like, I'm sweating constantly. I'm really nervous. I don't know how it's going to play out. And I think the biggest worry was our investors had made an investment in our company almost 4 years earlier, and we could have sold the business for 5 to 6x that investment.
Yep.
I could have paid everybody,
everybody
would have been home run. I would have gotten high fives everywhere. My staff would have been happy. The investors would have been happy. It would have been a great 6x return. And instead, we raised debt.
We leveraged it all
and said, like, these two companies together can be worth more in the future than a 6x right now.
Yep.
And then that really meant you had to execute that acquisition in a real, in a almost perfect way. Or in my mind, I thought of it in a, had to be a perfect acquisition. And then it was. It was this perfect acquisition after, which gave us the opportunity to go acquire ZoomInfo, because the financials of that first M&A transaction were so
well. And you good. Also showed you knew, you know, people don't understand that that M&A side, mergers and acquisition and consolidation side, is really a testament to other people's confidence in your ability to execute. And I always say there's three integration points: cultural, operational, and financial. And it's very difficult for business owners that haven't experienced something much bigger to take their business at a certain size and then massively grow it and integrate it into somebody else's cultural, operational expectations.
Yeah.
And then get it all to work
financially.
Well, financially.
Yeah.
And I'm going to just tell you, because I've known you, I've watched you, I've listened to you, I've seen you from afar. The reason I think, based on my experience, the reason I think your acquisitions have gone well is because you're a good person and you're humble and you have productive paranoia and you care about what people think, because the first meeting I had with you, those are things that you said were important to you. And people who come in like a bull in a china shop and they're better than everybody else and they're bigger, I'm the acquirer, I'm going to shove it down your throat, they don't succeed just because they don't have that humility and appreciation for the human aspect of what's involved with making these things work. And that takes me back to, like, how big were, for my listeners, how big were you as a company and what were your revenues when you raised your first ever money, and what valuation did you do it at?
Yep. So I founded the company when I was in law school. I was 23. I put $25,000 on my credit card. My co-founder put $25,000 on his credit card. That was our financing. Mm-hmm. We launched the business in Columbus, Ohio in 2007. So there was no venture capital money or private equity money coming into, you know, a law student and his buddy's startup selling data out of Columbus. And so we knew we had to build a profitable business, because there was going to be no money that came in that allowed us to grow the business other than the profits we were generating in the company. And so year one, we did $300,000 in revenue. Year two, we did $800,000, $2.7 million, $5 million, $15 million, $33 million.
So I met you at the five mark.
You met me at the
five. You know what's crazy? I you just proved a point, and I didn't prompt you to do it. I always tell business owners, when you ask people questions and they're bullshitting you, they're vague about how they respond. But when you did it, you never forget your numbers.
Yeah.
You just rattled off your numbers by year, which I do for all my companies, all the way back to Sonus, because some things you just never forget.
Yeah.
And if you've actually done it, those are so ingrained in you that you know when someone's like, well, you know, I did a little bit, I'm doing a little better of it. They're bullshitting.
Yeah.
So anyhow, I meet you at the 5 million mark. So you went 5 million, then what'd you do the next
15.
15.
And then I want to say, I think we went 5, 15, 33.
Wow.
And between 15 and 33, we took outside money. So it was year between 6 and 7.
And how much did you raise?
It was secondary.
What was the first?
This was the first money in.
Oh, okay.
So it was secondary in that the money went to myself and Kirk.
Oh, I got it. Okay.
To buy a portion of the business.
Got it.
And so we were, at the time, call it a $27 million revenue business with 45% EBITDA margins, growing over 100% a year at that point.
Wow.
And the valuation was like $275.
Wow.
And they bought 51% of the business.
Yep. Man. And then from there, it just exploded.
And then it just, continued to do what it was doing. and then had an opportunity to do an acquisition 3 years later.
Do you wish you held off taking that?
I think about this question.
I have a lot of friends. I have a friend that sold at a $75 million valuation, sold 75% of his business in 18. And they said, keep doing what you're doing, patted him on the back. He took $50 million off the table. And then in 2021, they sold it for $550 million. He's like, if I had just bypassed that.
Yeah.
But then he said, I don't know that if I would have the courage, because it does give you a sense of freedom. Like, okay, I've got a backstop. I can keep going.
Totally. Like that day, I remember that day. Like, I remember every moment of that day. I remember waking up at 5 a.m. to get on the wire call and getting on the phone with, you know, a dozen lawyers from us and a dozen lawyers from them and, you know, their whole crew, and them going around the horn being like, TA, do we have your approval for the wire? Henry, do we have your approval for the wire? Okay, the money's being sent, and being like, okay.
I remember staring
in
at
a minute, I'm going to get it.
Were you staring at your
I remember when it came in and being able to like see those dollars. And actually, like, there's also this weird feeling that like all of your wealth is flying around in wires, you know, like in the air somewhere, and you're waiting for it to land. So that moment, it really was like this, felt like an exit, financial exit.
Yep.
It never felt like an exit for me from the business, but it felt like real financial freedom.
Yeah.
Then, so I thought about, should I have waited? Could I have waited longer? And would that have been better for me? And when I think about it, what it really comes down to is, where did my private equity investors really start adding value that I couldn't have figured out on my own?
Great perspective.
And there's a lot of value that they add, but a lot of it you could probably figure out on your own. But I could not have bought my closest competitor in 2017 without access to the capital markets, access to a real private equity investor, a real investor behind me. That wouldn't have been possible. So that meant we did the acquisition in 2014. Or we took money in 2014. In 2017, we did the acquisition of a company called Ranking. We sold at 25. We're about $80 million when we went out and made that acquisition. And so that delta between 25 and 80, I'm confident I could have done without help. Mm-hmm. After that, I needed a proper board. I needed proper private equity investors. I needed better mentorship. I needed governance, and I needed access to the capital markets in a way that I don't think I could have done on my own.
Yeah, there is a, and you can never take back. I mean, it's been such a great story.
Best,
and you've created
no
so much wealth.
Yeah, totally.
But at the end of the day, it is always a question with thank God you didn't take money at $10 million or $15 million, right? Because that would have been fairly dilutive compared to almost $300 million valuation for your first transaction. So, you know, it's funny. You sent me, when you and I connected, you sent me the email that I sent you in 2013 or something it was.
Pre-investment.
Pre-investment. And let's see. And I was like, I remember writing that to you. Geez, there's so many emails between us. Let's see. I'm just curious if I can find this thing. Do you have your phone on you?
I don't.
So let's
see. But it's definitely in your, I think I sent it to you in that text.
Oh, is it text?
Text is probably less noisy.
Yeah, that's probably where it came from. Yeah, you sent it to me. I just want to read this. Because I go back and read it, and sometimes I'm like, God damn, I wish I would have known, you know, because of what I'm doing today. You made a point.
Yeah.
This is really what my calling was.
Yeah, totally.
But I had to build operating companies and get my own skill set. And after doing the private equity route and going public, it didn't work out for me so well. And I had to, like, come to terms that I was part of the problem there, right? And that's why I say I think, based on my own reflection and the decision-making I made while I was out acquiring 130 businesses and stuff, versus knowing and watching you and seeing your humility and all that stuff, because I was pretty much like, I'm just gonna make it happen, right?
Uh-huh.
But I wrote this to you after you came and saw me, July 2013. Henry, equally as a pleasure meeting you. I'm looking forward to developing a relationship and watching your continued success. Just remember, leadership isn't something you do, it's who you are, and it takes focus, intention, and continuous development to grow. True leadership is nothing more than influence. When you use your influence to help others see, act, and attain in life, the true impact of all your intelligence and business wisdom will multiply beyond your wildest dreams. Then people will not only be impressed with what you can do, but more importantly, who you are.
Yeah.
And because I saw you, this was still by 2013, I had reflected on all my previous mistakes. And I was actually in my power move in 2013. My business was compounding every single year, 5-6 times Inc., you know, and Entrepreneur of the Year, all that bullshit. And so meeting with you and seeing your humility was a reflection going back to when I had a $5 million business with Warburg Pincus and thinking I was just going to take the world over and charge. And then that's ultimately why I think why they were like, hey, things are good now. We're going to sell out. Because if I would have invested in the me then, I would have been like, okay, we're lucky to get, because I always use this analogy. If you took me and Michael Phelps out a mile offshore and you said, okay, guys, swim to shore. And the people on the shore are making a couple different bets. One bet is who's going to get there first. Well, it's obvious Phelps is going to get there. Second bet is who might not get there at all. Well, I'm going to win that bet every time because they're going to be like, this guy is not Michael Phelps. He could drown. Now you're watching the swimmers. And Michael Phelps is going to take off. Boom, he's going to be to shore. He's already going to be into his Mai Tai and getting a massage by the time I get to shore. And all along on my way there, I'm going to look like I'm 1 second away from drowning because I'm going to be flailing and panicking. But I get to shore, and I'm going to be like, I made it. I broke through. I didn't die. And I'm going to be all proud of myself. But to everyone else looking at me, they're like, God damn, they could have gone the other way. This guy could have died, right? And that's what the private equity group was seeing. They were watching CEOs that were just like you, just consistent, humble, do what they recommend, easy to come alongside with. And then there was me back then, 29, 30, 31 years old, doing everything everyone said I could never do.
Yeah.
And busting through and building this false identity that I'm just going to break through every glass ceiling. I'm just going to do what I think is the right thing to do because I was always in survival mode. But if you're watching that to the sophisticated person, they're watching somebody flail around that could either sink or swim. I'm celebrating survival. They're like, thank God we can get our money out of this thing and double our money.
Yeah.
And so when I look back on that in reflection, I created those conditions for them to be like, all right, we're ready to sell. And I vowed I would never put people in that position again, right? And that means I had to change as a person. And that was the journey I was on. And then I met you. And that's the reflection. I see a young entrepreneur come in and you're like, hey, man, unlike me, you were like, I'm building a team. You were so humble that you were willing and vulnerable in the things that you knew you weren't good at. That's contrasted to me. I was like, I got it all figured out, man. I'm going to figure it out. In fact, if you were the me coming in to see me back then, I would have met with you and went, who knows what this guy's going to do, right?
Yeah.
And to see so much success and to see you evolve as such a strong leader and such a impactful entrepreneur, because really you're one of the few that have gone through so many cycles. It's one thing to become wealthy and build a business and sell it and get out, but you're still in the cycles.
Yeah, totally.
So, I would love your perspective just on how you maintained that sense of humility, because you're the same guy now that you were back then, because you expressed like how you view the world right now.
Yeah, I'll tell you first, a corollary to your story is actually before I took money in 2014, I had gone through a cycle with another private equity firm. And in my mind, the transaction with private equity was like, again, like a financial exit. And so showed up, these private equity guys looked at the business. They said, listen, we really like it. We want to make an offer. And they said, well, what do you want to do after we make the offer? Like, what do you want to do at the company? And in my mind, I thought, you're going to write me a $20 million check. I'll do whatever you want me to do. I do not, whatever you want. And so I was like, whatever you guys want, I think I'm pretty good at marketing. I can continue doing that. I can do some of the sales stuff. But you tell me like what you'd like me to do. And they're like, great, let's introduce you to some new CEOs. We'll bring a professional CEO in here. They'll run the business. Okay, great. You're still going to write me that $20 million check. So whatever you guys want. And I went, I started interviewing CEOs with them. That deal fell apart, thank God, because I think back to that moment and I think like, wow, I almost let myself get robbed of this incredible experience and this incredible journey and all of these challenges and learnings that I've had from there to today are monumental. And I almost just gave it all away. And I think that there are differing perspectives about private equity firms. And there's probably like a lot of negative out there about them. But there's a guy on my board, his name's Todd Crockett. That guy, he really believed in me. And so when he saw me swimming to shore and Michael Phelps swimming to shore, I think, you know, and when you saw me, I'm a public school graduate. I didn't go to any Ivy Leagues. I was raised by a single mother. I have no experience in business. You could see, like, when you're looking at you and Michael Phelps swimming to shore, you could see like the fast swimmer to shore and go like, that's the guy I want to bet on. And I think he saw me and you struggling to get to shore, 1 second away from drowning every minute, but somehow coming up for air again and going and going and going and going. And he was like, that's a better thing to bet on than somebody who has had a kind of an easy way to shore. I want the guy who's dealt with adversity, who's going to fight through it all the time. And so, you know, that big bet on that first acquisition, it was a bet on my ability to put these two companies together. And he was looking at a 6x return too. You know, like that's his whole professional career is, can I return 6x over and over and over again? And instead of taking those dollars, he also said, nope, I'm going to let it ride. And I'm going to let Henry pull these two companies together. And then again, with ZoomInfo, when we went in between the Rain King acquisition and the ZoomInfo acquisition, we had another private equity firm come in, the Carlyle Group, big private equity firm. They, at that moment, TA and Todd had the opportunity to sell all of their stake again and ride off into the sunset. Now, it would have been like a 12x return or 13x return. And he was like, nope. He went in front of his investment committee and said, I don't want to sell all my shares in ZoomInfo. We can sell part of it. I want to hold on to the majority of it, and I want to let it ride on this next stage of their growth. And so I was afforded this opportunity because somebody on the private equity side believed in me and my ability to succeed. And you're dancing on the razor's edge of that often. And so I appreciate how lucky I've been to receive this opportunity. I worked my ass off for it, but I also appreciate how fragile it was along the way.
Yeah, I think you've said a couple things that are quite interesting there. First one is, I believe if you would have sold to that first group, everything in your life would have been different.
Yeah.
And the fact that they didn't have the confidence, there's just so much to unpack in that moment, because I've been there too, where you want to say, look at your money. I trust you guys. You wouldn't be betting on us. Yeah. You make the choice.
You went to Harvard.
We gave all our power. We're giving our power away in exchange for some money.
Yep.
That's only temporary. They would have brought somebody in that wasn't committed to the business, looking at purely financial returns. How big can we build it? How fast? How do I get my money out of this thing? Because they brought a CEO into my business and screwed it up. Of course, I had already said, you know, I'm not selling. So they brought him in because they knew I wasn't going to play along with it. But
yeah.
At the end of the day, that would have been a huge inherent conflict, because you're a good guy and you would have been like, yeah, how can I support this business? And that person would have started making different decisions that you wouldn't agreed with. And then you would have found yourself in conflict. So that's normally why people have a bad attitude about private. Had you done that first deal, mm-hmm. you probably would have a bad attitude about private equity.
Yep.
But you fortunately waited, and then you found the right partner, and then you were the right partner to them.
Yep.
And you had somebody you believed in and that you listened to who believed in you. And I think that's when private equity really works well. I had that too with Warburg, but after the third year, because when I wanted to do a couple of big acquisitions, they were all over it. Through their teams at it, they were with me. We just never could get any of them across the finish line. And then as I started making other decisions for the organization, they started losing confidence. I know exactly what happened when I go back and look at it and be real with myself. And so I guess the moral of this story, if you're listening to this, is taking money earlier on, if you don't need to, is probably not the right time to do it. When you can take enough money that it's enough coming off the table, you're like, okay. Because that second time around, it's like, all right, well, shit, it's a fan. I'm set for life.
Yeah.
And I think that's a good time to pull maybe some of those chips off the table. When you look at the scariest moment of your career, like the one where you're like, oh, a momentary freak out. Like you're like, oh my God. You're like, oh, this could all go bad or whatever it is. That was there a moment where you can relate to? I have one very specific, but was there a moment where you're like, that's that moment where I was at my highest wigged out spot in my career?
Yeah, there's two. And I'll give you one because it's the better one. I turned 40 this year. It was my birthday was in July 30th. And July 31st was our earnings release. And I knew earnings was not going to be great. And we had internally missed our number. And there were some things that I was moving around in the business. And I knew that I had to go. It was the first time I had to go in front of my investors and tell them that I missed, literally. Like, I had gone 16 and a half years, almost never, I don't think ever missing a number or a quarter. And I knew that a bunch of, the way the public equity market is structured is, you know, you meet with a bunch of investors, the big ones you have a relationship with, never as close to what it's like on the private markets, but enough of one that you know they believe in you as much as they believe in the business and want to get a financial outcome. And I knew I was going to have to go in front of all of these people and tell them, like, I blew it on the quarter. And I knew they were going to be disappointed in me. I knew the stock was going to go down. I knew I expected my employees were going to be super disappointed in me, and they were going to have questions about the company and all of this, you know, bad stuff. And so it's my 40th birthday, and my wife is like, what do you want to do? Like, you know, you could do anything, go anywhere, do anything, bring anybody here. What do you want to do? It's like, I just want to eat dinner with you guys, go to bed, and deal with this shit show that's going to come tomorrow.
Yeah.
I just want to be on the other side of it.
Yeah.
And so I did. I ate dinner at like 5:30. I went to bed at 8, woke up, took my medicine the next day, got through the other side of it. And the big realization for me is that setting expectations is really, really important. And I did a bad job of setting expectations with my investors. And when you set bad expectations or you don't meet the expectations you set for yourself, you chip away at the trust that people have in you. And so I learned that lesson the hard way. That was a really crappy moment. So that was one big one. And then, you know, look, being the CEO of a publicly traded company is very different than being the CEO of a private company, mainly because you're always on. And something that you don't have any control of, some outside person or some report or some analyst or something, can just show up on your doorstep any moment of any day. And you are going to be responsible for showing up and answering questions about that or guiding whatever the next steps are. And so you are always on. And I haven't, you know, I'm on my fourth year as a publicly traded company. In a couple months, it'll be 4 years. I haven't quite figured out how to, like, cordon things off.
People don't understand how difficult it is to be the CEO of a public company. People dream about it, talk about it. But you just made 16 years of always winning. You have one freaking bad quarter due to all sorts of probably circumstances. And it's almost unreasonable for the average person to think that every year for 16 years, I'm just going to always be better and better and better and better and better. And yet you're expected to be when
absolutely
you're a
public company. Expected. Yep.
And you can go from hero to zero fairly quickly in the public markets perspective. And then you got to earn, claw your way back, and all these other things. And so I always tell people, look, it's not for the faint of heart. Like the thrill of being a public company CEO, it is a different talent, different skill set to be a public company CEO than, like you said, a entrepreneur or CEO of a private business, because you're really just answering to the stakeholders and maybe banks if you have banking relationships or used money. When you think about that, what do you think you actually enjoyed more, being the bigger than life public company CEO? Because it is fun. It is when you're good at it, there's a draw to it. But did you like the guy that you just had you and your partner and maybe a private equity group to worry about?
So, two things jumped out at me when you were saying that, but I think one of them is when we were about to go public, my wife was like, why are you doing this? Like, you've got this great private company. Everything's going well. You like what you're doing. You answer to a small group of people. Why would you go do this? And I was like, listen, when you get invited to the Super Bowl, you don't say no to the Super Bowl. And IPOing your company is the Super Bowl of business.
Yep.
And no matter what you told me, if you told me, like, of course you could have IPO'd your company was IPO-able, you made the choice not to IPO it, I would go the rest of my life regretting not taking that opportunity. And so being on the other side of it and feeling like the challenges with it, the different, all of the different speed bumps along the way, I still look back and go, I would have made the same decision 100 times over, no question about it. Was it easier being not a public company CEO? Definitely, 100% it was easier being a private company CEO than it is being a public company CEO. But there are a lot of things about being a public company CEO that were much harder 4 years ago that are much easier today.
Yeah.
And, you go through these cycles where you just kind of like learn what happens after a tough event as a public company. And then you know what happens. And so if another one comes, you know exactly how to deal with it. And so experience over time, I'm sure, will make it a lot easier. But definitely it was much easier being a private
company. Well, and I know you well enough that I'm going to ask this question only so the listeners or the watchers on my YouTube channel can understand what I'm going to say. But I know one of the biggest advantages of being a public company when it works is the fact that it's really easy to give back to your employees a multiplier of their effort through the public company success.
Yep.
How many people from startup to now do you think that you've created enough net worth or significance that it changed, it put them in a position for their lives to be changed?
So on IPO day, we minted about 170 millionaires.
Oh my God, how good does that feel?
Yeah, it was pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. I keep track of how many millionaires I've minted as well. And so at Odyssey, I had about 120 millionaire, multimillionaires. And since coming here, I'm at probably at 200 now.
Wow, amazing.
In 4.5 years. So like for me, that's my body count. Like how many millionaires, multimillionaires can I mint? But what I haven't been able to do is mint that inside for my team yet because, right, we're not public. There's no liquidity for them. And the process in a private company is entirely different than what you can do in a public company. And I think that's one of the best reasons to go public is so that you can provide wealth for the teams that helped you create and build the business. And so for that, man, I know that we're bumping up against some schedules here. All I got to say is that I'm so freaking proud of you, dude.
Thank you, Brandon. I appreciate it.
You are a good dude. I knew that when we first sat down. And I wish you would have back then taken up my offer for $100,000 for 25% of your company. But I was too dumb to make the offer. I should have made it, damn it. But look, you've done something that very few people on this planet get to do. You're an exceptional class of human beings by creating so much value for so many people, not to mention the value that your company creates for businesses that get to work with you in order to improve their company. And I know that you and I are going to have something fun to share with the marketplace and the community here in a few months. I tell you, from me to you, I just really look forward to actually doing something big with
me
you.
Too.
And I'm super proud of you. Congratulations on your success, and thank you for joining me on my show.
I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
All right, everybody. Thank you for listening and watching for another episode of Building Billions with Brandon Dawson, talking to Henry about how he's built now Zoom Info into a multi-billion dollar company from startup. I hope this inspires you to think about what it's like to start, grow, scale, and maybe exit something substantial or run something bigger than you ever dreamed possible at the time that you started it. Either way, our job here is to inspire you. If you like this show, share it, like it, and comment on it, because this gives us the incentive. It gives us the passion, the joy to continue to shoot these episodes. So thank you for joining me on another episode of Building Billions with Brandon.